Committee, we're going to start off today by having an update on the aggregate situation from Rich Angstrom, in that those of you who are involved with land use in the last session know this is the last place in the world we want to go. Rich, if you'll come up and kind of update us, because I know you've had a lot of activity in the interim, and we just want to make sure that we don't really touch on aggregate if we can avoid it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rich Angstrom, President of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. I asked the Chair if I could just come up and update folks on where we're at with the mediation process and what the agreement that went forward when we all signed up for the mediation process after last session. I know you guys are seeing the aggregated interest kind of lurking in the background on this thing, but it's not that we are taking an active role. We're just trying to make sure that the agreements moved forward during the mediation process are honored. And essentially what happened is after last session, which didn't accomplish the goals that the industry felt we needed to get accomplished, we went to the governor's office and asked the governor to set up a mediation process. He talked with Karen Minnis, Speaker Minnis, and Senate President Peter Courtney, and they initiated a mediation process, and they got the TCU folks from Portland State on dispute resolution, the public policy group, to start a mediation process. The first meeting, we laid out the parameters of how we were going to work this consensus process. And one of the most important pieces of that is that while we're in mediation, we would not run land use legislation that would affect either side. So the industry, the reason you haven't seen aggregate legislation in land use front this time around is we're part of that mediation process. It's moving forward. We're honoring our agreement. We're just making sure by happenstance or otherwise that somebody doesn't cause a problem with the Measure 37 issues as far as the industry is concerned. So where we're at is as far as our interest on this bill is the bill should not advantage the industry or disadvantage the industry. It should stay neutral on the aggregate industry, and the mediation group is picking up this issue, including Measure 37, and hopefully next session we'll have an agreement and come forward with a resolution on how we're going to handle aggregate as a plan. So if I offer any suggestion, it's only going to get us back to a neutral situation as we move along. I've been monitoring the issue. I'll be looking at the amendments around high value farmland and some of the other issues around residential and commercial and industrial, and just making sure that we're on a status quo basis until we can get through the mediation process. I thought it was important to come out and clarify that for everybody so that they, and including the folks, this is a message not just for the committee, but the folks in the background of what the interest of the aggregate community is for this bill at this time. With that, that's all I have to say.
Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Committee, given the outline of the time available to us, we know we have amendments coming to the amendments, the dash 3 amendments. They will not be available until Monday. Today we are going to hear the dash 4 amendments. There are dash 5s. And probably the dash 5s will not be officially presented to the committee, at least at this time. So what we're hoping is that we'll have, 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe, we do have 7s?
6 and 7.
4s became 7s. Okay, the 4s became 7s. Okay. That tomorrow we will have basically all of the amendments that we're going, or the tools that we're going to have to deal with in front of us. So tomorrow we will begin our process in this committee of deciding what moves forward and what doesn't move forward. It is the chair's hope that by Wednesday of next week, we will have a product to move through the process that will be guaranteed to get through the process, at least time-wise, if it all plays out the way we've been told it may play out. So, and committee, if this committee will make the decision on Monday, if we need the time, we will go to evening meetings in order to accomplish our goal. But that will be a committee, the committee's choice. Okay, but we'll make that decision on Monday.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I've raised this question a few times, and I don't feel satisfied just working off of amendments and drafts that are presented by stakeholders alone. And I suggested at one point that we should submit some single amendments among ourselves to see what we could do to fine-tune some of these bills. What I'm doing is going through one draft now and making a list of correcting or clarifying amendments that I think might be necessary. I could probably have that process done by tomorrow and just submit it to the committee, but I would like that to be able to be considered in part of the mix as to what would be going in the final draft. And I think anybody can do this, but I would feel more comfortable if we have a greater input than we've had.
I think any...
Now, this is my opinion, committee chime in, but I think any amendment from a committee member will be welcome at any time during the process. I think we need to leave ourselves that flexible.
So how much would be a timeline in the submission of the committee material, the committee amendments, so to speak, to the materials that have been submitted?
Well, if we're looking at trying to have an end product by Wednesday or Thursday of next week, we can probably go till Friday, but I'm figuring that it'll take us, you know, at least a couple sessions after we pretty well have the document put together the way the committee feels it wants to put it together.
Well, I can have my work product done by probably by late tomorrow. I just don't know when I can get it distributed, but I'll make a...
I fully expect that we will begin the process of putting this bill together on Monday.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments from committee members? Okay, we're going to then look at the dash sevens, and Bob, Elon, if you'll come forward, we'll kind of follow the same process that we did yesterday.
We should have committee
dash seven amendment plans.
I don't think I've got them either, Frank.
Oh, yes, I do.
Number 6 and 7.
I do have them.
Yes, Bob. Stacy, 1000 Friends of Oregon. Yesterday, my colleague, Karen McLaren, hand-highlighted copies that were distributed to you by the committee clerk. If you have those copies with you, it will be easier to follow along as I go through the sections. What we tried to do is indicate those sections that we propose to amend from 3120-1.
Remember, the dash sevens you received yesterday do have the highlighted areas.
Yes.
Any committee member that does not have?
Oh, wonderful.
Looks like.
Sorry, I forgot to bring another set.
I think I just gave you a question. They had yellow highlighter in certain sections.
Representative Greenman, the first place to look would be on page 2 if you don't have
that. I just got a clean copy.
It's 2 names. It's still the general name.
I'll attempt to refer to the line numbers and page numbers.
Yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and take my copy?
No,
go ahead and take my copy. And we'll follow along here. I have the assistance of Sam to keep me out of trouble. Committee, in just a couple of moments from now, Representative Nolan and I will leave the committee to meet with the governor's staff. And, Bob, I hope you'll excuse us,
of course,
from hearing your testimony at that point. If we are not back by the time you've completed, then Representative Anderson will put the committee at ease until we do get back so that we can discuss that with the committee.
Thank you very much.
Okay, sir, please. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having us. Elon Hassan of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, you know well. I'm Bob Stacey from 1,000 Friends. I appreciate this second opportunity to visit with you. I won't go over again our policy arguments that we made when you first heard House Bill 3120A, a week or so ago, but focus on the proposed amendments. We were aided, the committee was aided greatly by the hard work of the Legislative Council Office in taking our amendments, which were by line, conforming them to the proper language, and then inserting them in as amendments, if you will, to the dash one. So you have a complete bill in front of you. Nonetheless, I'm going to focus only on the changes we made rather than attempt to walk you through the entire 3120 as introduced to the committee. So I would direct your attention to top of page 2, lines 3 through 6.
Okay. Are the highlighted changes the changes that you've added to another version we had?
That's correct.
And the version we had was the
dash ones.
Was the dash ones. Thank you.
And I called that the committee bill, but it's in the chair. Sure. This is a provision establishing a threshold for loss that would trigger compensation or waiver under Measure 37. So this constitutes a proposed amendment to Measure 37 as restated in the bill. The concept here is that in order to claim a loss that is entitled to compensation or waiver, a property owner would show a loss of at least 25%. 25% of the value as of the date the regulation was applied, the effect of the regulation was felt. The premise here is that Measure 37 is a fundamental change in the zoning power of government, that today, in 49 states, government regulates, subject to state and federal constitutional limitations, which prohibit regulations that go too far in reducing the value of property, regulations that take away all economic use of property. And there's been a lot of debate about how big the gray zone is between all economic use being taken and regulation that it goes far but not too far. The state of Texas, when it passed legislation establishing a property rights rule prohibiting significant reduction in property value by new regulations, picked 25% as this threshold. We're in a new frontier. We're one of three or four states that has a mechanism like Measure 37. Measure 37 is a 100%, or put it the other way, any reduction rule. So any zoning ordinance that has any impact to reduce property value by a dollar or more triggers the effect of Measure 37. This proposal is that for that effect to occur and for the potential of waivers, that is, the authorization of uses in violation of the zoning ordinance to be granted, there should be something more significant than 1% or 0.5%. Our proposal is 25%. This is important for all waivers and all decisions on compensation, but I think it has its greatest significance with respect to the future application of Measure 37. From now on, all communities in Oregon will be governed by a rule that in order to zone, one must first determine that the zoning has no impact, no adverse impact on the value of any land in the city or county, or find some means of excusing all current property owners from the application of zoning ordinance, something that no other community in America does. This would give some leeway to cities and counties to adopt some level of reasonable regulation that has some impact, at least in the near term, on property owners, but doesn't go beyond 25% of value, current value. Without further argument. The second amendment is on page 3, lines 6 and 7. This is part of a list of exceptions from the requirement to compensate or waive, the exceptions that are built into Measure 37. And this adds a new proposed exception. It is similar, slightly broader than the proposed additional exception that was explained to you yesterday by the work group. It would say that land subject to the coastal goal protections adopted by LCDC and worked into local government, city and county comprehensive plans on the coast, those regulations would be exempted from the requirements of Measure 37. premise here is that most of the provisions of the coastal goals with respect to coastal shorelands, beaches and dunes, and estuarine resources relate very closely to the kinds of natural hazard conditions and habitat or wetland conditions that exist in these scarce and fragile coastal areas. Build a house on a dune or cut down a dune in order to preserve a view and you endanger that property and the property of natives. So the premise here is that those regulations, which are tied to those kinds of natural process areas where the waves are shifting and the wind is blowing and the landscape is changing on an annual or every few years basis, would be a further clarification of exemption from Measure 37. The next change is on page 5. And this is fairly significant. Lines 4 through 14. There's been a good deal of focus by us on the premise that there should be a compensation mechanism. This committee's bill in the -1 draft contains a source of potential compensation in that very long section about recapturing farm, forest, and open space deferrals when a waiver occurs in order to provide resources for paying compensation for other waivers. This provision takes an additional avenue and says when compensation isn't available and waivers are granted, they ought to be granted in the same spirit as compensation. Compensation is a payment for loss. The value of the property went down as a result of the regulation. And so the first proposed rule here for a waiver is that the uses allowed by a waiver should be proportional to the loss suffered by the property owner. If you lost $100,000 in value, the development you're allowed under a waiver should get you about $100,000. It's less important to be dollar for dollar than that there be some proportionality, and you're not getting a 400-unit subdivision because you were told you couldn't build a single house on your property. The second test is one to, wherever possible, prevent damage to neighbors. Measure 37 is an effort to ensure fairness for property owners, to prevent government from going too far. Fairness to one shouldn't result in unfairness to the neighbor. And the provision here is intended to say that the development under the waiver should not be designed or at such an intensity that it impairs the property values of neighbors. Finally,
Mr. Chair, did you say the 25% level ought to apply here as well?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Greenlake, yes. In our draft amendments, the 25% rule applies prospectively and retroactively both.
No, I'm talking about the 25% level in response to impairing the neighbor's property.
Once the Mr. Chair,
you say significantly, and I was just...
Oh, I see.
I was looking for the definition of significantly as being the same 25% you had.
Yeah, I would accept that as a friendly clarification. I think that's a better rule than simply saying significant.
Thank you.
Can I just ask if this relates to residential or really the farming interests that you're trying to protect? Whether it's the dust or smell of animals or something like that that is impacting the neighbor, or is it just, I don't want to have somebody that's anywhere near me.
Mr. Chair, clearly the impetus for this is to prevent interference. The first thoughts in our head were with agricultural use, but it's stated as a general rule, and so it would have application, for example, inside an urban growth boundary. Under current Measure 37, a property owner who's held property since before the zone would have the right to develop inconsistently with current residential zoning, for example, and so it would serve as some protection to neighbors against a building so tall or otherwise having such large impacts that it would reduce property values. Subsection 8 says that with respect to later provisions of these amendments dealing with allowed development on farm and forest land, which allow specific levels of development under a waiver, that building those houses allowed by these sections is deemed to comply with these limitations. So if you're in EFU or in a forest zone, you're entitled to a waiver, and you get the development that's allowed by sections 13 through 13B of our amendments. That's all you have to do. You don't have to make the showings under A and B above that's low impact or proportional. It's deemed to be proportional. It's deemed to be an acceptable impact on the adjoining agricultural uses. If you'll turn to page 11.
Lines 22 to 25 describe
rulemaking by the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. There's been a lot of confusion, a lot of uncertainty about how to value loss under Measure 37, what level of evidence is required, whether an appraisal is required, what kind of tests of value loss are the most accurate. The appraisal community itself has had a wide variety of opinions. This directs DAS to develop rules, which later in the bill further explains will be further implemented by professional guidelines promulgated by the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board. Those amendments are at page 25, and they basically say DAS adopts rules, the Licensure Board looks at those rules and develops professional standards for appraisers in accordance with the rules. So appraisers know how to handle these complex questions of changing property value, sometimes changes that occurred a long time ago or under regulations that have been in place a long time. Page 14, there is a provision, this is the deed restriction provision, in cases where a waiver is granted by the county and by the state for development on farm, forest, or mixed farm and forest land, and in other cases indicated on this page, the property owner receiving the development rights under a waiver gives a deed restriction back to the public, ensuring that the balance of the land would be available for use for farm and forestry, that there will be no further development of the land that would be inconsistent with the zoning that applies to it. Next, on page 18, simply an insertion of definitions of Eastern Oregon and Western Oregon for the purposes of the changes that I want to turn to next, which are on page 20 to 21. Our draft amendments continue a concept that was developed by the Senate of distinguishing between high-value farmland and all other farmland, and applying two different levels of protection, or if you will, two different kinds of waiver opportunities, depending on what kind of farmland we're talking about. High-value land, under these amendments, a waiver would be limited to a tract of record right. A tract of record provision similar to that contained both in the work group amendments that you saw yesterday and in Senate Bill 1037 states that on a high-value land, property owner is entitled to build a dwelling if that property owner was entitled to build a dwelling on the tract at the time the tract was acquired by the current owner. It's essentially a one-house development right. This contains a lengthy, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing, a lengthy description of the soils and areas that qualify as high value. These amendments are informed by work of the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the vintners who proposed these jointly to the Senate committee. Several of the amendments that they proposed were not included in Senate Bill 1037. And we've tried to put them all together here into a single definition of high value. So this includes what one often thinks of, Class 1 and 2 and prime and unique lands, soils. Many of those are concentrated in the Willamette Valley and in the Umatilla Basin. in the upper Columbia portion of Oregon, and in pocets of land in the Rogue, the Umpqua, and other river valleys. In addition, the orchard lands of the state, the wine grape growing regions, and certain irrigated croplands, I believe this defines it as including all irrigated croplands, a very important category of land in eastern and central Oregon. Finally, although they're rarely thought of as high value in terms of their soils, this definition proposed by us includes important ranch lands. Ranch lands often have, there's no other word for it, poor soils. If you've been out to Cook County lately, driven up the upper Cook River, you don't see very much lush bottomland. You see a little bit and a lot of highland. It's arid, sparsely foraged. It's critical to the operation of large ranches to have that land base intact. And this attempts to define those circumstances as well. I'd urge you not to take my word for it, because I don't ride a horse, much less run a ranch, but to consult with the Department of Agriculture about this set of definitions, both with respect to wine grapes, croplands, orchards, and the ranch land soils. They'll be, I think, more persuasive about the reasons for selecting these criteria than I can be. But the goal here is to describe in a way that counties can apply, and the Department of Land Conservation and Development, the Department of Agriculture can apply in advising those counties, which areas ought to have the limitation of allowing a dwelling for our Measure 37 claimant, as opposed to a partition, which would be allowed under our amendments, on the balance of agricultural land. That's in Section 13A. 13A describes both the... 13A describes the other agricultural lands than high value. And simply says, if you look at page 22 and 23, it takes several paragraphs to say this, but the bottom line is, in 13A, if you have non-high-value farmland, non-important rangeland, section 13A.
13A1A?
This is A1. Land use regulation in effect that restricts the residential use of land that is not high value, but is zoned for farm or forest.
That's supposed to be highlighted, or?
Yes. 13A, all of section 13A.
I got it.
On those lands.
All these pages are highlighted.
Yeah, it's a long, long, long section. I apologize for that. Better to highlight them to miss it. That on these lands, under our proposed amendments, the limit on a waiver, a development under a waiver, would be one partition
between three parcels,
each of which would be buildable with a single-family dwelling.
So farmers, ranchers, rural
property owners who have land that's designated agriculture or mixed ag and forest, not on high value, would have the power, if they had a Measure 37 right, to create a three-parcel partition with full development rights of those three parcels. The next change.
Where is that part on the three part? I see the one, but I don't see the three. 13A.
13A describes that the new parcels are not smaller than 20 acres. B, the dwellings comply with the standards for approval of the dwelling as of the date the owner first acquired the property, which in most cases means they can build the dwelling outright. Comply with C is local health, fire, and safety. And I get three, Mr. Chair, from the fact that under state law, partition means to divide into not more than three parcels.
Cool.
And you notice there are also some siting standards about keeping it 250 feet away from the property line in order to protect the adjoining farmer from direct interference. And excuse me, 13B contains the provision for forest land waivers, which is a dwelling on small forest parcels, 40 acres or smaller. Sorry if I'm rushing. Next would be page 25. I've mentioned this already. These are the directions to the appraiser certification and licensure board to develop rules in conformance with the DAS rules on how to do appraisals of loss under Measure 37 claims. And now I believe I can take us all the way over to the next to last change I wanted to mention. And this deals with an additional source for revenue for compensation. Mr. Vice Chair, I was out of town on Monday and Tuesday, but I saw the paper and I understood that the chair expressed pretty strongly that witnesses should not come before the committee and propose ideas that weren't going to leave the building. So why don't I not go in great detail through this description of our idea, but really try to illustrate it with an example.
So where are you now?
I'm now on page 67 through 73. That entire set of sections, 34 through 57, describes a process under which the state would impose a fee on certain land transfers. The basic idea here, see, I'm pushing away, I'm not going to go line by line through it, not going to take too much time, is that a 20% fee would be paid by the seller on land on its first sale after being brought into an urban growth boundary in the future. This doesn't apply to land currently in urban growth boundaries anywhere in the state. It would apply to new urban growth boundary expansions and the first sale of property after that urban growth boundary were expanded. Yesterday you heard testimony from Dan Cooper from Metro about the recent experience of Metro. He said from 1997 till now they've been pretty much in a continual process of adjusting, expanding the urban growth boundary. And so that would give us a way of looking at how this would work had it been law during the most recent expansion of the urban growth boundary in Portland. In 2002, Metro adopted an 18,000-acre expansion of that huge urban growth boundary in Portland. Most of the land brought in was agricultural or mixed agricultural and rural residential. Outside of the urban growth boundary in the Portland region, the North Willamette Valley, well, the best agricultural land is now selling for around $10,000 an acre, reflecting a high level of productivity and demand for those soils. Just inside the urban growth boundary, land in Washington County has been selling in excess of $400,000 an acre before sewers are extended, before roads are built, on the marketplace as builders are attempting to consolidate large parcels for significant developments. $10,000, $400,000. Let's assume that there's a net difference of $300,000, not $390,000, just $300,000 from that first transfer. The seller makes gross $300,000 an acre before taxes, before broker fees. This deal says 20%. On those 18,000 acres, at $300,000 an acre, I didn't believe this myself, I did it three times, it's $1 billion at 20%. That's a lot of money to extract from those transactions. The other side of the coin is those sellers, before they pay their fees to the broker, are pocketing, after paying that billion, $4 billion more from those sales. 18,000 acres brought into the boundary, significant expansion in value. $1 billion that the state would collect under this fee would go to property owners who had Measure 37 claims in Athena, Corbett, in Cloverdale, in the Meadville area, closer to the urban area of Portland, but across the state. For 20 years, Oregonians have agonized about the fact that we've had enormous growth and development on some of the best ag soils in the state, up there where the Willamette meets the Columbia, and the 12th and flows into the systems. And across the state, local economies have languished while Portland has boomed. We're not going to talk about this any further. It may not be within our grasp this session. But ideas like this, capturing value where development is occurring, and transferring that value to people who did get pinched, I think merits careful consideration, and I think addresses some of the concerns about the overall fairness of the operation of the Oregon planning system. Final amendment, the effective date, our measure, recognizing that we propose a revenue source, does not have an emergency clause, but specifies an effective date for the changes of February 1st. So if you have a Measure 37 claim, it's in process. You've already filed it before February 1st. You can choose either to continue under existing Measure 37 or to refile under this measure. Now, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I probably took longer than you expected.
Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, thank you for your rather quick explanation. Very helpful. Generally speaking, how does this, your amendments relate to the measure, to the Dash 3 amendments? Not in detail, but in, how do you see the conceptual differences between the Dash 3 and the Dash 7?
Mr. Chair. First, don't put me on the spot. I've had the same amount of time as you have to fully absorb the work group's proposal, and I don't want to rush to judgment. I don't like it, and that colors my views as well. If you were... one difference is we're saying 3, they're saying 10. Just to put it in very simple terms, if we accept the premise that we're not going to find resources to pay compensation to property owners, and we need to identify a mechanism for managing Measure 37 that doesn't involve paying people, our difference is we propose that 3 home sites on agricultural land, 1 home site on high-value agricultural land, should be adequate compensation for a Measure 37 claimant, and the work group suggests 10, unless people are willing to wait 2 years, and then as many as 100 for a very large parcel. My first blush impression is that that's a lot of impact on a lot of agricultural land. I think it's impossible for any of us to know how much, but we know that there's 16 million acres of private land that have farm designations on them in the state. If you just divide by 10, which is very gross, overestimate, that's 300,000 home sites over the implementation period, if you assume that about 20% of Oregon's ag land has a valid Measure 37 claim. I base 20% on the sample that we have reviewed in Washington County. The triangle between Highway 26 on the north, Cornelius, and Forest Grove on the south. In that area, 12,000 acres, right around 20% of the land remains untransferred, except within the husband and wife relationship, since 1975. So 20% clearly eligible for Measure 37 claims. Don't know if that's a representative number for the state as a whole. Certainly don't expect that every single potential development right in southeastern Oregon will be developed. But you're talking well over 100,000 home sites added to the agricultural lands of the state under that measure. We would suggest that 10 units, 1 unit for every 10 acres, even if you cluster them, is probably more than the realistic and reasonable expectations that people had in 1973-75 that caused them to hang on to their land, continue to farm it in a farm zone for 30 years. That something less than that is an appropriate limitation. But we have also said, again, violating the chair's rule, that we think there's a role for compensation, and that compensation is a salve that could be made available to property owners who don't think 3 home sites is enough.
We want to build compensation around, and that we work harder to develop a compensation program using that big machine of the program.
Thank you.
Representative
so speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick question. Of the 16 million acres that you said are ag lands, how many of those are considered high-value farmland?
Under the definitions, Mr. Chair, under the definitions now in effect, as part of the tract of record, lot of record law of 1993, something less than 25% of the state's farmland. Our amendment goes farther because it includes imports and ranch land, and that's a very large category.
I've been kind of meditating over the same problem. How many homes are we going to have? It appears to me at this point in time we're under maybe 1,000 total, but rising.
Claims.
Claims at this time. Do we have any statistic telling us how many are, say, for one only, for five or less, for 20 or less, for 200? Do we have any demographics on that?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Rindy can.
Mr. Rindy or Mr. Shetterly would be probably in a better position, although I have to acknowledge they don't have all the data either. Because we have this county by county, city by city process, they know what the Department of Administrative Services has received and how many of those are for one or two homes as opposed to a subdivision or a Walmart. But then there are folks who have started to the county level, and there it's very difficult to know.
I guess what I was thinking was I could anticipate we might have 5,000 claims when we get all through. I think a great percentage of those are going to be ones and twos. I think we're probably going to have a number of twos and 200s and 300s. But I would be surprised if we have more than maybe an average of 10 homes per acre. That's why I'd like to kind of, because if we had... You were talking 100,000 homes. If we had 5,000 claims, then that's probably three or four times more than we have right now, and I sure appreciate that it's going to go up. We'd have potentially 50,000 homes, and that doesn't seem to be too great a number for a population of 3,500,000 people, especially when there's tons of land out in Oregon that hasn't been touched. Maybe Mr. Rindy would like to come forward. Do you have any guesstimates or thoughts as to what's coming in from the counties?
Mr. Vice Chair Anderson, we can get you that information. I don't have it today or at my fingertips. As the claims are coming in, we are doing a quick cataloging as to what is being requested, recognizing there are some claims that aren't clear as to what is being requested. It's my understanding that by far the claims are for subdivisions or partitions, but as to the numbers, I would have to go back and get some research to get you an answer.
Good. Mr. Chair, I remember correctly the last time Director Shetterly gave a review of the claims before his agency. I think they tabulated that at that time about 84-85% were subdivisions as opposed to single-family homes. But he did not indicate the number of dwellings that or lots that represented.
Was that the last meeting?
It would have been several meetings back when he gave an update. Yes.
We missed a good part of last meeting. Any other questions for Mr. Stacey?
Just one clarification. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Stacey. The 20% revenue that you were talking about, was that on everybody that's being drawn into the urban growth boundary? Was that the way you... Am I correct? Yeah.
Yes, it would be... It would apply as drafted to every urban growth boundary expansion that occurred from this year forward,
right,
and to each parcel brought in. It would be a net differential, so it wouldn't be an assessment on the value of the property, but on the amount by which it increased from the time you got it until the time you sold it.
Okay, regardless whether you had a Measure 37 claim or not, that had nothing to do with it. Okay.
Yes.
I got it. Thank you.
They would already be paying a 9% capital gains on this. Would this be a 29% tax on?
Well, it's a fee, Mr. Chair.
A fee?
It's
not a user tax, it's a user fee.
I'm not a tax expert, but I do know that, as John Chandler likes to joke, none of his people would stay in business if they paid capital gains on the land transactions that they're involved in because of the 1031 provisions of the Federal Tax Act. I'm not familiar with the Oregon provisions to what extent they vary from the 1031 exchange provisions. Folks in the development business avoid that. Folks who make a single sale of property could be subjected to a 9% state capital gain tax as well as this 20% fee. But of course, the 9% is on, it's on the difference. It's on the difference.
And a 1031 or a Starker is not an avoidance of tax, it's a delay of tax.
Indeed it is.
Yeah,
I suppose the issue here is if the notion of Measure 37 is if a government action reduces the value of property, then the owner should be compensated. And here the notion is if a government action increases the value of property, then a share of that increase ought to be given back to the government, if you will, for other purposes. And I suppose that's the kind of equity statement that's involved in this. So.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, if we leave the government out of it, I prefer to say one group of property owners reaps a big gain from the operation of these land use planning rules. Another set of property owners loses, and we should look to that set that reaps big gains to find some portion of that gain to compensate with. I don't think the government should get too much out of that transaction.
Well, I consider we the government as opposed to they the government. So.
I'm a loyalist myself, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. We'll, of course, be available to the committee to
go ahead. maybe we could talk a little bit about development rights and tell us how you think that impacts us.
Development rights, Mr. Chairman. Would you aid the witness by giving me a little more sense of your question?
Well, I think it's going to pull us together a little bit. The if we are to be charging the person for an increase, maybe let me shift this a little bit. That isn't that's a new concept. We haven't had that as in say 68 or 69 or 72. We're charging people for the ability to rent to develop in a sense that they didn't have to pay before. And I'm just wondering if you know how we deal with the idea of bringing in something new, the right to develop, when in fact when Measure 37 especially there was nothing. It's just a question of what did you have on the boards at that time. You can't do that now without any change, without any development right, essentially, I mean development charge.
Mr. Vester, first of all, one goal in trying to devise this system is to make sure it doesn't impair development rights as they exist today at all. So it doesn't apply to anybody's current right under current zoning or current urban growth boundaries to develop. It talks about future changes only. And so the first step a property owner has is to say, you know, on reflection, I just assume not go into that urban growth boundary, not get that upzone. I'd like to remain as is. Second step, as I enter into negotiation about the sale of this property, I'm going to determine what I need to get for it, bearing in mind that I have this transaction cost. And then the third step, and it's one that the development industry is particularly focused on, is this measure says, our amendments say, it is the seller who pays this fee. The buyer, in the ordinary transaction, is the developer who builds houses or other uses of the land. The seller is the person who had the land under the old zoning outside the urban growth boundary, now has the land inside the urban growth boundary and reap the benefit of that change, and then pays a fee on it, and then passes the urban land at an urban land price onto an urban developer. So there's no goal here of thwarting the transaction, thwarting the development, or surprising somebody who today has a development right and is going to get taxed on it. This is all about prospectively assessing this fee in the future when land gets bumped up significantly in value.
So it's totally future?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, asking another question. If this committee passes out 3120 with the dash seven amendments as you propose them, will you be issuing a floor letter recommending a yes vote?
If the committee wishes it.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm asking a question. Let me ask it in a different way so I can make it.
Some people don't want to clear. Seek our support.
Everybody looks very carefully at any floor letter that comes
in.
We decide which way to vote. But my question is a serious one. I mean, are these amendments, in your mind, if we pass these amendments, and we're clearly not going to pass any one set all alone, but if we pass these amendments and pass the bill with these amendments in it, would you be enthusiastically in support of the bill in this form?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair. Mr. Chair, our goal is to find a mechanism for implementing the vote of the people on November 2nd. We think part of that is finding a means to put some money into the system to make it work more fairly. And so we would support the bill with these amendments, even though it means some waivers on some land affecting some farm development, the farm use. And it doesn't, and our amendments do not go nearly as far as some of the other changes, some of the other proposals in terms of limiting Measure 37's impact on our own lands. But we would support this package and urge the Senate to support and the government to sign.
Mr. Stacey, I'm just having looked it over here for, 45 minutes. I see it as kind of two suggestions. One really land use or the way we will deal with the dividing up of the land, and then compensation. If you were given the choice between one or the other, which would be the most important to your organization? Implementing the compensation or implementing the changes in the land division?
Mr. Vice Chair, we would support the compensation approach. The waivers that we describe here, the one house on high-value farmland, the three lots, the three parcels on other agricultural land, those are exceptions to the Measure 37 rule that the government can select either to waive or waive. And they say, in these circumstances, a waiver is limited to this amount of development. On the balance, except for the coastal zone, our amendments say government continues to have that choice. But government now has a source of revenue.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Right. Thank you both. Yes,
sir.
Representative Singer.
In Measure 37, help me, I don't remember. Did Measure 37 in any way draw value from classes of land? High-value farmland, was that something mentioned in Measure 37?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Representative Sumner, no. These are amendments that would depart from Measure 37's general rule, which is pay or waive. Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Pay or not apply?
Not apply, thank you. Waive is a slang term.
A little heartburn on their way. Thank you both for coming. I appreciate your work. Is there anyone that does not have any major amendments that are coming forward that would like to speak? We have a few minutes before. Mr. Laney, why don't you come forward? These are brief comments tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, Senior Staff Attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. Just wanted to briefly comment on the development rights equalization assessment that is contained in the Dash 7 amendments that were just brought before you. We are very much opposed to this concept. Without speaking to the rest of the Dash 7 amendments, I would like to focus on a couple of issues here. First of all, the idea that...
Hello, would you pull the
microphone closer? What we're talking about here is whether you describe it as a new fee or a new tax. It really is very much like a new capital gains tax of 20% on these properties, and making it payable upon transfer of the property makes it look an awful lot like a selective real estate transfer tax, something that my members cannot support in any way, shape, or form. It's based on, and this specific assessment really it strikes me as something that it's not, because it's based on a faulty premise. It's based on the premise that what has happened here is the market has created an increase in value, a significant increase in value, and that is something that needs to be taxed at a rate of 20% in order to compensate other people that did not see that increase in value. When in fact what it is an increase in value that was created by the establishment of the urban growth boundary in the first place. What all the government is doing here is giving rights back that were taken, 10, 20, 30 years ago from these landowners, because at that point they had the right to subdivide, to build houses, to do the things that they would be doing now that they come inside of the urban growth boundary. So what you'd be doing is creating a precedent where the government at some point in the past takes value away, and then at some point in the future returns that value, and then levies a tax of 20% on that. And I want you to think about that for a moment, because that opens a very scary door for us. I mean, that's not something that's ever been done before. To my knowledge, it's not been done in this state or any other state, because what you're doing here is you're allowing the government to create value and then levy a tax upon it, a very heavy tax of 20%. Also wanted to mention, for the sake of the committee, that these property owners are paying increased taxes. Their property taxes will be reassessed for the value of coming inside of the urban growth boundary. The limitations contained in the property tax limitations, they are excused when property is upzoned, so they would be reassessed at this much higher value. Many of these landowners will be paying capital gains taxes. Some of them will be going through 1031 deferred exchanges, some of the big developers, but some of the smaller guys would in fact have a 29% state tax, capital gains tax, not to mention the federal capital gains tax on top of that. So this could very well approach a 50% tax on the increased value that these landowners would see. I wanted to mention the 18,000 acres that you've heard about that were brought inside of the urban growth boundary of Metro in the past several years. Most of that land is still sitting there undeveloped. Yes, the urban growth boundary did expand by a very significant margin. Yes, it expanded in 1997 as well, but much of that land sits there, unbuilt upon, undeveloped, in many cases unplanned. And you will be hearing a bill addressing that issue shortly. But that land, for all intents and purposes, might as well not be inside of the urban growth boundary because nothing is happening there. And you've seen the result of that in the Portland area, where the inventory of homes in the market has reached an all-time low. It's less than a two-month inventory of available housing. Supply and demand, when supply continues to go up and demand goes down, that increases the price dramatically, and that's what we're seeing in that market. Another thing that this
you said that wrong.
I'm sorry, Chair Anderson, we're saying kind of like, what did I say wrong?
I think you said when the supply goes up and the demand goes down, that increases the price.
I stand corrected. When the supply goes down and the demand continues to go up, that makes the cost, the price, go up. Thank you for that correction. It would also discourage investment in these properties. I mean, no other state would have this new 20% tax. Not to mention the fact that what you would see happening is sellers would build this additional tax into their sales price, and that would drive up the cost to the buyer, which ultimately would be passed on to the new home buyer, so you would see the cost of housing go up even more than it's already going up. And finally, I just wanted to leave you with one last comment on this. Nothing in ballot measure 37 talked about new taxes or new fees. It talked about compensation or not applying, removing, or modifying land use regulations. There was nothing there. I think this is a huge departure, a tremendous departure from what the voters intended when they passed the ballot measure. When they were talking compensation, they were talking about utilization of existing resources if the government deemed it that important to continue with the regulation that reduced property value. They were not talking about a new 20% tax. With that, I will conclude my remarks and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? I have one. And Mr. Stacey may want to comment on this too, I'm not sure. He mentioned that the property outside the UGB was selling for 10,000 acres, essentially EFU. That inside was $400,000 in Washington County. I think I know the answer, but could you tell me what you think it is that makes that discrepancy?
Chair Anderson, what happens is the available uses. When the land gets rezoned from exclusive farm use and brought inside of an urban growth boundary and upzoned for rural residential use, you can now build houses on that land, and that drives the value of that land up significantly. I don't know about those figures. I would imagine they're pretty close because we have seen, especially in Washington County, the value of raw dirt inside the urban growth boundary is significantly higher than it is outside. It's the available use, it's the government authorizing these new uses, namely new home sites, that drives that valuation up.
I understand that, and I appreciate that's probably a good part of the answer. But I think what we're seeing in Southern Oregon is that the minute you establish a zone, smart people come in and buy that land up, and it just gets bid up without being built up. But pretty soon you have a lot of people sitting holding land for a profit, for an investment, but nobody wants to build on it because it's so expensive, and it takes a while for the market to catch up to where there is nothing else, and they have to purchase it. Is that part of the equation?
Chair Anderson, that is also a factor as well. You have seen some of the larger some of the large tracts, particularly the rural residential exception lands, get bought up and people sit on them, and speculators are waiting and waiting and waiting until, you know, the price is high enough that they will use that land for development purposes.
So in a sense, we've been captured by our own process that it's making it difficult because of the land use zoning to have enough land that's reasonable enough to be built upon.
Jameson, that is correct. We have an inventory problem in a lot of the markets here in Oregon, and that's driving the price up significantly.
Okay.
Smart people are buying, dumb people are selling.
Well, smart people with future plans are buying. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Lindquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Lindquist, Oregon Business Association. I have just one particular concept and a point that I'd like to try to make. Yesterday, unfortunately, I was not able to hear all the hearing because we had a board meeting, and so I had to run out when some of the real good things were happening. But at the board meeting, I discussed this issue, and it's consistent with what we've been before. There's a lot of concern out here that Measure 37 has prohibited land use planning. The fact of the matter is, for the 80% of the land, or you pick the figure, whatever it is, that's not on the Measure 37 claim, this has not done anything to that at this point. The real issue that I think we are not contemplating sufficiently is what is going on in the future. And I would suggest that history will bear out that if we were to pass 3120, for example, without any threshold clause in there at all, that the impact on the future would be greater than what we're going to do with 37 claims we have at the present time. We would support some sort of a threshold on future planning processes. I'm not going to suggest a number. You people are the authorities on this and have a much better grasp on that than perhaps we do. But the idea here would be so that we don't simply shut down the planning from this point on, because such little things as a sign ordinance could trigger a 37 claim in the future, because someone could show there was a reduction in value from that if there's no threshold whatsoever. So it seems to me that there's some way that we could come to resolution of some sort of a threshold that I believe would not seriously alter the intent of 37 for those who have already happened. It would have no impact on them. But at the same time, not put ourselves in a box where we were prohibited from making any changes from this point on.
Your comments on that?
Sir, what could we possibly do that would put us in that box?
Vice Chair Anderson, in summary, for example, as I understand it, if the interpretation is right under Measure 37, if your land is devalued either in past times or in future times, that you would have a claim. Okay. So, for example, in Bend, I know they're considering a sign ordinance, and that would preclude someone from putting up a certain sign. I think it's very possible to economically prove that my land has been impacted because now there's a sign ordinance and I don't have the ability to bring in traffic as I would have before. And so that's just a little example, and I think the intent of Measure 37 was not aimed at those kind of claims, if you will, that. And so I'm simply saying, if someone, if we're astute enough to move through the morass of 37 under the past actions, and at the same time not put ourselves in where we preclude any kind of planning, if you will, in the future.
I agree. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Lundquist. I think you pointed out something we all struggle with. My question is, have there been any Measure 37 claims on future, on regulations that have taken place since November 2nd?
Vice Chair Anderson, to my knowledge, not. I know that there are jurisdictions that are thinking, Bend is an example of that.
What if?
Yeah, exactly. You know, if we do this, then the city of Bend is going to have that. So,
it's even more than that, because I've been working with the planning process in one of my neighborhoods, the Linton neighborhood, and there was a lot of work on it, and one piece of it in some hillside land, there were suggestions that there needed to be some zone changes, some up zones, some down zones in that change. And the city attorney of Portland sent the planning group a letter and said, stop what you're doing right now, because any of those zoning changes could trigger a Measure 37 claim, and we're not prepared to deal with them. So, I mean, this was 2 months ago that this really stopped a very simple planning process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my point is, if you can't think of a solution, how would we expect to come up with a solution for the future by Tuesday or Wednesday of next week?
Reverend Anderson, Reverend Smith, if I heard the question correctly, if I don't come up with a figure, I think it's just a matter of which percentage is applicable. Is it? I'm going to be extreme here. Is it 2% or is it 50%? It's probably somewhere between those two. Keeping in mind what the chairman that I've been here has said very succinctly, that it needs to be something to get out of this building.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that this is something that is very huge in impacting the future, and does not, excuse my words here, maybe materially affect the intent of 37 And so it's sort of that compromise, and I'm just, what I was just referring to is, I'm not sure the right percentage. You know, I've heard Texas 25%, 8,000 friends have talked about 25%. I'm not hung up on the percentage, I am hung up on the idea that I think we're foregoing an opportunity if we don't struggle with that issue a little bit.
Thank you, I agree.
I think in the very first meeting we had, I really echoed what Ms. just said, that I'm very worried about Measure 37 going forward. And I think there are some things that we can do in terms of future use. I don't think the voters were thinking forward. I think the voters were thinking about straightening out all the inequities that had happened over the last 30 years. I'm going to prepare an amendment, for example, that exempts zoning decisions inside urban growth boundaries for Measure 37 claims. And I think we're going to deal with a situation like we'll expand the urban growth boundary. We won't tax the profits, but we expand the urban growth boundary. Land has a value. It's now unlimited. We then come in and zone that land. We have the potential for reducing the value from what it was before you zoned, even though the zoning is a part of the process that goes on with the urban growth boundary expansion. And it seems to me there are some things we can do to clarify what really does trigger a future claim. And it seems to me zoning inside the urban growth boundary should not be, in the future, should not be a Measure 37 issue. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing I think we can begin to think about those, and I think we can think about those in the next week.
Seems to me that, thank you, Representative Kralik, that many of the initiatives that have been thrown out by the courts in past years have been because they've dealt with several issues instead of a one issue for the initiative. And I understand that legislation is a little different, but it seems to me that we're adding things in to what we think Measure 37 did say or should have said, or what we want to say in the future. And I worry that unless we stick very close to what Measure 37 said to the best of ability of those that voted for it, and I think they should be primarily the ones we listen to. Both sides should be heard, but I think it's those who voted for it that say that should have more say in what they were voting for. But if we start diverging and adding things in and talking about the future, like Senate Bill 82, I think we're going to get off track, and we may have a lot of problems getting it through the courts as well. So maybe, in my opinion, I think maybe we ought to try and close it down as close as we can, keep it as simple as we can, and then pass the 82 or whatever else comes forward to deal with the future. Take 2 years or 4 years, as has been suggested, and really replan and then pass it by the people and say, is this what you wanted?
Vice Chair Anderson, I'm certainly not in disagreement with what you're saying. I think we need to be very careful, need to be very careful in how you respond to the statutory Measure 37. It's not before like Measure 7 was, or on ballot Measure 7, that was constitutional. So you have that opportunity, and I hear what you're saying. I guess I would just push back just a little bit.
Sure.
The polling that we did, as that you all have, clearly showed that our Albanians want personal property rights protected. No question about that. They also did say that, you know, planning is not all bad. I mean, it's very clear that they said that as well. I have my own feelings about how you analyze that. When you look at that geographically, the three areas of Deschutes County, Southern Oregon, Southwestern Oregon, and Eastern Oregon were very, very clear, if you look at any of the charts on the polling, that they are significantly different than Multnomah County and the Valley. And you know how that is. But the fact remains, even in those areas where they were saying private property rights are very, very important, it doesn't mean they want to throw all the planning out. And I would suggest that this is I mean, Measure 37 did speak, I mean, by being being quiet on it, I guess it did say that future activities will be any zero tolerance. No threshold at all. That's what it's really saying. And so I'm simply saying that as the policymakers of the state, are you changing that significantly or not? That's for you to decide. I understand exactly what you're doing, and I'm talking about this. And again, I want to emphasize the chairman's idea of getting the scene out of the building. But is this one of those things that would help get this out of the building? Stay basically true, I think, to the fact of Measure 37, and at the same time help make your job such that you can be successful. I mean, I'm sure most people testify, we want you to be successful in this endeavor. Absolutely. And I've testified before. If there's anything that I can say, the bottom line is I think you owe it to the people of Oregon to do your very best to make it workable so that we don't have another initiative, you name it, that can come out again.
Except it seems to me, and you know, I think you're really right, but I think the problem is most of us aren't mind readers. I mean, we all think we know what the voters wanted, and except we think different things about what the voters wanted, which leads me to believe we may not know what the voters wanted. And that really does need to say if we can't really make changes, then we ought not make any changes at all. We ought to let it roll for 2 more years. See how it goes, see where the courts go with the things that are going to court, and then try and figure it out in terms of where we're going next year, next session, because
we're
willing to say, here's how we can make it
better, but I'm really not willing to say, here's how we can make it better based on what we know the voters really wanted. I don't know whether the voters thought it was going forward or thought it wasn't. I mean, I don't know what they thought. I don't know whether it was just the first 3 words they read or they read everything. I mean, I don't think we ever really know what the voters wanted. We all think we do.
Refer it. They will.
Refer, like with Measure 47 and Measure 50. Create a new, rather than creating an answer now, create a referral that sends it to the voters and see if they want what we say.
Send them the answer and see if that's what they were thinking.
I don't think we've been talking about that as one of the possibilities.
I didn't say we were.
No, but I mean, that could...
Mr. Chairman, the response to that is that, most of you know that, I guess I'm trying to consider the policy walk a little bit. I've worked hard, and I think that our association is working hard trying to do what's the best for the state. And as we, you know, many people talk about, we can't change this, or it's education funding or something else until we get we get into the good graces of the voters. Well, frankly, I don't think you can get into the quote-unquote good graces, but I think you can make efforts in that endeavor. And I think as you struggle with a very difficult issue, to walk away just because we don't know what somebody thought, and we all think different things, I'm not sure that serves the legislative process, the political process, the policy process of Oregon in the best way possible.
I wasn't making that point. I'm willing to try and work hard to figure out how to make Measure 37 work. What I'm not willing to work hard to do is to make Measure 37 work in the image of what we think the voter wanted Measure 37 to do. I mean, I've been arguing from the beginning to make Measure 37 work, but that means we need to think, and we have lots of different views here, we need to achieve consensus among us on how to make Measure 37 work, including changing it in some ways if that's what it takes to make it work. I'm willing to engage in that process. It's a process that says, I'm going to make it work so it's like the voters thought they wanted when they voted for it. That's the process that I think is a problem, because I think that's, you know, sort of arrogant.
Well, James, I'm sorry, Representative Ackerman, I think you have your hand on.
I got my question answered.
Okay. Let me change the subject a little bit. We've got a little time until the chair comes back. You're with a group of businessmen, essentially. What are you hearing from your group in terms of compensation? What are your thoughts or ideas as to what
what kind of compensation we could offer, where we could get it?
Unless you understand, from the business community, as you're describing here, there isn't much discussion that I have heard. There may be, but I have not heard much discussion on compensation. The discussion I've heard just in kicking around has been more in the land, you know, rural land in those areas, in the business, in the industrial sector, commercial sector. Really haven't heard much about that.
Anybody else like to comment?
Can you agree?
We're going to stand at ease for a few minutes and ask for your patience. Joining us, and after the recess, and we are adjourned until tomorrow at 1:15.